Welcome to The Machine, a computer science education podcast from the Southeast Technological University, SETU, formerly Waterford Institute of Technology, WIT, but that's who we are now, and you can check out setu.ie for more details about that. My name is Rob O'Connor. I'm a lecturer in the Department of Computing and Mathematics. And on today's episode, which is the first of this short series of The Machine that's coming out just at the end of the academic year, we have some of the original band back together. Siobhan Drone and Eamon de Lester, who both appeared on the very first episode of The Machine 4 years ago. How are you?
Hello, how are you?
You've done a lot to this place, Rob. It's fantastic. I mean, you've got a huge chair. When you've been here before.
I know. It's the amount of technology in this studio. I think we changed the bulb in that light.
But it's a trophy cabinet. I like it. Podcaster of the Year and Golden Podcast Award. That's fantastic.
And the sign up there about not playing Desposito in this studio. That's actually really there. There's a list of banned music that is not allowed to be played in this studio. And Desposito is on that. So the only person who's missing from the original lineup is Mairead Maher. So we'll have to get her back on to an episode soon. Today, we're going to talk about second languages and I suppose programming languages that you learn after your first. So it could be second, third, whatever, insert whatever number here. I'm going to start by asking you a very simple question. What was the first programming language you learned and what was the tool set that went with it? So Siobhan, we'll start with yourself.
Okay, the very first one that I learned, now bear in mind this would have been back in college in 1991, and I would have learned Modulo 2, and do you know who taught me it?
No.
He's sitting beside me, Mr. Eamon de Lester, yeah.
What's it called? Modulo?
Modulo 2, yeah, yeah. So that would have been, it would have been Pascal kind of based, and it was very procedural. If I have to get all my questions right now, my description right, because he's sitting beside me now. How much was I paying attention? But yeah, it was...
A model student, is that
right? Yeah, thanks very much.
And I'm reading that out of a listener.
So what was this, would this have been, would you have been using a VAC system or something for this? This wouldn't it be PC based, would it?
Oh, everything was done on the VAC mainframe, and it was procedural language. So it was kind of real, follow the sequence and the lines of code that were written. And my memory of it is very sketchy because it was 1991. But we'd have written a lot of programs at the time for Eamon, like kind of assignments and stuff like that. It was Pascal kind of based, if I remember rightly. Do you remember?
Yeah, it's well, my first language was Pascal, actually. Ah, and that's really? Why you learned Modulo 2.
Really? Your second language.
Because in the 70s, Pascal was all the rage as a teaching language. And when I came to WRTC first, it was still Pascal. But Modulo 2 is kind of successor to it, slightly more sophisticated. And, obviously, with sophisticated students like Siobhan, I couldn't fall back on
Thanks very
Pascal
much.
At that stage. So Modulo 2 was introduced.
And what would have been the tool set that you would have used back then?
In the 70s, it was all what you'd call dumb terminals. You may remember what they were. Just a terminal with a green screen. Not too far in the 70s from teletype, in fact, that was still being used. My very first programming project was punch cards. We're talking a long time ago here now.
Right.
So your program was on a deck that you submitted and you got the results a few hours later or the following day.
So this is where you wrote a program by punching holes in the cards and then you fed the cards into the machine and then you either got a result or you didn't. If you made a mistake,
exactly,
back to the punching board.
Yeah, or if you dropped the card deck and it spread all over the ground, you had no way of getting it back together again.
Really?
Because you'd sort them all into the correct
That's
sequence.
A good excuse for not having your assignment ready.
So for students who are listening today and you're complaining about Eclipse or whatever it is that you're having yourself, it's a lot nicer than dropping cards on a floor.
We used to have another issue as well with when we did start moving on in college into PCs that we were using floppy disks. And the 3.5 were fine, but it was the 5.25 were a wicked problem because they'd bend. So you'd have your assignment ready on them. So it's a 5.25-inch floppy disk, but it was really floppy. So if it bent, it wouldn't go into the machine again and your code is on the disk, but you can't get it running. So you had to be so careful of your assignments that you didn't bend your floppy.
Okay, you might need to cut that out.
So I would have been just a couple of years behind you, Siobhan. I would have started on C++. Actually, Eamon, I would have had you in second year. And Mairead would have had Mairead in first year for programming, but it would have been C++. So in those, it would have just been a couple of years later, would have shifted from Modulo 2 to the C family of languages. And again, we would have started on a VAX, although we did move to PC, I think the following year. I think we were the last year to use the VAX, possibly, which is an old mainframe system that I believe was in situ since the early 80s. I think it was.
It's commissioned in 79, I think, here.
79, and you can hear all about that in the recent WAT 50 podcast that I made. seriously, there's a section in it about setting up the first computer here in the college and all the stuff that went along with that. Okay, so what we're talking about there is that so the three of us start, I worked in C++, Pascal, Modulo 2. C++ is really the only of those languages that you'd find today. Really. And in even use, then, yeah. It would be probably a different it would not be the C++ of the mid 1990s. What was the second language that you would have jumped to? So, Eamon, shall we start with yourself?
Well, back in those days, if whatever your first language was, your second language was probably going to be Fortran.
Okay, is that because that was very heavily used in business? Is that correct?
It's heavily used in kind of numerical computations, but it's popular in universities,
right?
So, and in colleges, so you would be tackling that probably a bit blind because Fortran is a step back, in fact, from Pascal. But if it wasn't Fortran, then most people's second language getting into the 80s would be C,
right?
And that would start a journey then to the C family of languages, which we're still living with today.
Mm-hmm. And Siobhan, what would have been yours?
And that's the journey Eamon took us on. So we did start with Modulo 2 at the beginning, and then we moved into learning C and then C++. And bear in mind, when I was in college, Java was only coming out when I was in fourth year. So Java would have been a natural follow-on from C++. So it wasn't actually taught in college then because it was so new. And nobody knew whether it was going to take off or not. So I would have moved into the C family straight after Modulo 2 as well.
So C comes out in the early 70s. It's tied up with the Unix, with the distribution of the original distributions, Unix. C++, when does C++ appear?
C++ emerged around 77, 78 as kind of an issue. It's called C with classes. A famous computer scientist, still going, called Barney Stroustrup, invented it at Bell Labs. Became C++ around 79, 80, and really a mainstay language ever since. Evolved a lot over the years, but the bones of it are still intact.
So C would have been a procedure language. C++ was an object-oriented language.
Yeah, he was influenced by Simula, particularly language out of Norway, I think, in the mid-60s for simulation. He adapted straight into C++ ideas from that language. Mm. Most languages are in a kind of a family tree, you know, rock and roll family tree. They all have a lineage and parents and siblings and successors, and interesting to trace them and to trace the genealogy of any of them. And most languages that emerge today are firmly rooted in usually one or two of the main trees that have originated back then.
Which would be C. A lot of them are descendants of C, or it's probably C++, like Java and many of the other object-oriented languages that we're using today. Would you say C++ is an important language in the history of languages?
Yes, well, C family is, but going back further, most languages come from two roots. It should be Lisp and probably Algol.
Okay.
Maybe Fortran, just slightly ahead of Algol. And C is in the Algol side of the house.
Okay, right.
The AI side of the house would be dominated by Lisp.
Okay.
So the C family is kind of large now. It's still growing. Kotlin is definitely the C family.
Mm. Yeah.
Swift, C family.
Yeah.
And Go, of course, JavaScript,
Groovy,
Go, yeah. Groovy, C, C++.
So going back to when you started learning your second language, how did you find it? Was it as difficult a challenge as learning your first language, right? Because let's just assume that, okay, somebody is learning a first language, learning programming for the first time, it's a difficult challenge. You have to think in a different way than regular life. How did you find the jump to the second language, Siobhan? So you jumping into the C++
into
world.
Into C from Modulo 2. Well, the first language that you're learning, all of the constructs in that. So you're learning the flow of control of a program, your sequence, your selection, your iteration. And then in the first language, you're also learning a load of different other types of constructs and how you construct a program to solve a particular problem. So you're learning a huge amount of how you program in your first language. So then moving into the second language, you're just looking at kind of telltale signs of what's different between them. So the syntax is going to be different. Sometimes the type system is going to be different as well. You might have a strongly typed language, statically typed languages, dynamically typed. It all depends. But basically, the main message, I suppose, in going from one language to the next is you're doing roughly the same thing as you were doing before. It's just different syntaxes and different ways of handling your variables.
Mm.
That's how I found it anyway.
And Eamon, would you agree with that? Or would you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think in those days, we kind of resisted the second language because we just learned the first one. So what are you giving us the second one for? We haven't got the first one right yet.
Yeah.
And we were writing the same kind of programs. So we didn't really feel it was a big step forward to write the same thing, not as well in the second language that we had mastered in the first language. But I think for the kind of programming environment today, it's a bit different. The second language is often because something you want to do that requires a step forward.
Mm.
So if you're learning, let's say you're learning Java as your first language and you would like really to get into Raspberry Pi developments, let's say, Internet of Things and the like, then you'd probably be looking at Python as an option because it's easy to get set up there.
Mm.
Or if you wanted to mobile, you'd be looking at Kotlin or Swift or one of these languages. Or if you want to do the web, you've got to step into JavaScript. So it's those three areas. And if it's games, it might be something else again, would stimulate the choice of second language you'd explore. It's the domain as opposed to necessarily just revisiting the same thing again.
Mm-hmm. But as Siobhan was saying, whatever you've learned from your first language, you can probably carry it through or carry through an awful lot of it to second, third, subsequent languages.
Absolutely. I mean, we talked about family tree there. An awful lot is the same, really, for many generations. Lots of new concepts arrive at the edges, but the core features are fairly established since the early 60s, in fact, it turns out.
Yeah. So going back in time, so C, C++, I would have learned at the very start. And then I think it was in third year of our course, we did a Java course. Actually, Willie Donnelly, who's just the retired president of WIT, taught us.
And I gave him all of
them. Because we always kind of suspected Willie was half a step ahead of us. But anyway, at the time, I would have done my fourth year project entirely in Java. And largely just taught ourselves from books. Mm-hmm. This is pre-Stack Overflow. There was nothing like that. You just kind of got books and you figured things out. But I did find Java was quite an easy language to pick up compared to C++, because essentially everything was just the same. Some of the keywords were slightly different, but there wasn't a huge amount of structural differences to it. And all the tool sets were free, which at the time, a lot of the stuff in C++ wasn't. We used to have, I don't know, I think, actually, I'm not sure if you started this, Eamon, but without you now, back then, the C++ compilers were quite expensive. There was Borland and there was Visual Studio, Microsoft one. And there was a dodgy copy of Borland C++ doing the rounds in our class so people could install it on machines at home if they had one.
There's no statute of limitations now, you know, on copying software. Be careful.
Yeah. But like back then, I think it was like Visual Studio. It cost thousands and thousands and thousands for a license. It was huge.
It's all free now. It's a fantastic world, really, for programmers now.
Yeah, so I mean, nowadays, I don't think anyone would really pay for any development tools, unless they were really high-end professional tools, but I don't really see anything as being paid for.
Particularly as in schools and education, like. Mm. And a lot of companies also offer free educational packs. So like GitHub would, you can sign up for student packs and get a huge amount of free tooling from GitHub. So, and it's JetBrains the same, you sign up for your student license and you get free tooling. So you don't really have to pay for anything nowadays. Yeah.
Actually, no, you've made it. Tooling is an interesting point because I'd like to make the distinction between the languages and the tools, because that's, again, something that I learned a long time ago, is that the language often can be one part, but the tools can be just as equally as complex to figure out. Eamon, could you maybe just make the distinction between languages and tooling?
Yeah, the tools are very much tied to the thing you're building. So if it's a mobile world, then there's a lot of work goes into assembling all the pieces into something that can be put to an app store, that can be downloaded and used. Same with the web. Lots of different parts to an application. And those parts have to be built and deployed, we call it, as opposed to just something you write and run immediately. So students have to, it's a bit of a transition really once they get past their first language, because the first language they just know about the compiler, let's say, or the IDE. But as they go into broader domains, they realize that an app consists of lots of pieces, and orchestrating those pieces effectively requires tools. And the tools change quite a lot, actually. The languages are much more stable than the tools. So every few years, there's a whole new tool set starts to colonize the space, and the old tool set is retired. But the language might still be intact, but there's a new way of building the app, let's say, if it's a mobile application, rather than just the core application code itself.
I mean, I find navigating some of the IDEs and the build environments can be quite complex. It's probably like Siobhan and I and yourself, we've all kind of worked on mobile app development, and half the battle is often getting students set up with Android Studio. And however bad they think that is, I often kind of think back to the old Eclipse days when you had the Android plugin for that, and it was even worse. It can be, there has to be a better way for that.
For mobile, there is, I think.
Well, Xcode, yes. or React Native or something like that. Yeah. But in general terms, like...
Yeah. Well, there's newer tools coming out now as well. Like there's Jetpack Compose was launched there in September, version one of it. And that's basically you write the business logic in one area and you use Kotlin to do that. And you can then write small, tiny interfaces then for running it as a Unix desktop, running it as a mobile app, running it as an OS app.
Okay.
So you write your core logic and just plug on an interface in the front of it. Now, it's only version one and it's only just gone stable. So whether it'll take off or not is another one.
Okay. So I don't know what this is now. So if I ask you a dumb question, please... go easy on me. So are you talking about, so if we had a kind of a separation of concerns, model view controller.
It's that MVVM is what they use.
MVVM. Yep. Okay. So what's that?
Model view model.
Okay. So the idea is that you write your model code and then you might have multiple views and to go with that. Is that correct?
That's it.
Okay, right.
And they can deploy in different areas, different types of platforms, basically. So you're reducing your workload by keeping as much of the business logic together as you can and just only having, separating out the views for different types of devices you're going to use.
Okay. So again, let's go back to thinking a first year student is listening to this and they're going, I've just been getting to grips
with
Java.
First years.
I've been trying to get to grips with Java, never mind anything else. What would you say is, let's say somebody is approaching their second language. And let's just say for the sake of example that they've done Java as their first language, just for whatever. What would you, and they're going to a second language, what would you say is, what's the best bit of advice you could give them when approaching a second language?
So learning a second language, if they've done Java, what I would often do is look for a language that's similar enough in style and similar enough in type system. So what we, you know, the way we were talking earlier on about C++ and then moving on to Java from that wasn't that big a move because they looked the same and they acted the same.
Yeah.
So I would nearly do that as well when they're learning Java, move on to a language that will look the same and act the same. So Kotlin would be one of those. And Kotlin is a language it's around since 2011 and it's written by the people that own IntelliJ. And it's basically used for a lot of mobile development now. And what I was talking about there earlier on, that Jetpack Compose where you write your business logic once and deploy everywhere, that's written in Kotlin as well.
Mm.
So what I would suggest is picking a language that is similar enough to what you've learned and don't get overwhelmed by the language. When you look at the documentation, the reference pages, the API or whatever for the language, it's colossal. Only do small little bits. So maybe... learn, I'm going to actually do a basic CRUD app, console app in Kotlin just to get to grips with those constructs and then start building up different types of apps and learning it like that rather than going through and reading the API. That's how I did go about it myself because I had to transition as well. Like all these, like when we talk about learning new languages for students, we're constantly having to do it ourselves because we didn't pick a discipline that doesn't move you know.
Yeah. Could you just, you use the word CRUD there, an acronym CRUD. Could you just explain what that is?
So that's just a basic create, read, update and delete app. So you'd have like a console app where you would allow the user to add maybe a note or update a note, delete a note, list all the notes, maybe list notes that have that are related to work.
Yeah.
Things like that.
So it's a kind of a basic baseline functionality.
Exactly.
Eamon, what advice would you give to somebody maybe approaching a second language?
Well, I'd endorse Siobhan's approach, but I'd also possibly look at your second language as something whereby you might build something that touches the real world as opposed to just the screen in an IDE or a programming environment. So that could be then down to your interests. So it could be, it's on a web page.
Yeah.
Mobile, obviously, or in some sort of environment like a Pi, whereby it responds to something, responds to a button of some kind. So see if you can leave the isolated world of the algorithms and reach out for the real world, and then do it in the simplest possible manner. Just one button, press the button, does something, and then move in very small increments. And perhaps don't necessarily start by copying huge programs and hacking them to see if you can make them work. If you are going to duplicate a program and start, find the simplest one and go from the smallest number of abstractions and the simplest tool set up then gradually to something more sophisticated. And things are improving there. I mean, I think the newer web tools are getting better and they are starting to reduce the amount of cognitive load the programmers deal with. They realize that web in particular is way too complicated. And we're seeing improved and more streamlined approaches emerging, which means as a second language, you have a better chance of getting a foothold on it than 5 years ago would have been very hard.
Would you see a distinction between, I'm using air quotes here, okay, I know it's a podcast, you can't see it, computer programming and web programming?
No.
Okay. Yeah, good. I don't either. I'm thinking about our module catalogue at the moment, and we have this web distinction between kind of, we have the kind of programming, then we have the web, and I'm not really sure where that line is.
Programming is programming, really.
Yeah. So there's just multiple avenues. I suppose so many people experience computing now through the web. I mean, it's very hard, again, just with our nostalgia hats on, and we've been talking about stuff from the 70s and the 90s, and, you know, and the web. It's very hard to, it's hard for a student today to imagine what it was like a pre-web world, you know.
Absolutely. We didn't have the internet when we were in college. Like, it Gopher came out on the VACs at one stage. These are the VACs, the big old mainframes. And was it a Gopher? Wasn't that what it was called, Eamon?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you had to Gopher and you type in your search term and it would bring you back a text-based representation of what you're looking for in the internet. Now, bear in mind, when we were doing Gopher, there was very little out in the internet. There wasn't a huge amount there.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know, it's, that's how we used to browse the internet through a mainframe.
I suppose the web is how people experience computing. Well, maybe it's mobile apps now is probably the primary interface device, but that's what software is to humans, is web or mobile.
And
even coming back to the web as well, when for learning a new language, there's a huge amount of tools out there, web-based tools for learning. Like, I know I keep going on about Kotlin because that's the second language that I would have learnt whilst... heavily learned whilst having taught Java first. So basically there's a load of tools out there. Like, there's one called Kotlin Cones, K-O-A-N-S. And if you Google that, it's basically a huge amount of web-based interface where it's asking you to enter in a snippet of code in Kotlin and it'll tell you if you're right or wrong. It'll produce your output. And there's a huge amount of those types of tools for learning any of the languages. Like, there's JavaScript ones. So it's, even learning a language has gone completely web-based.
Yeah. I've used one with some kids in Coder Dojo, Trinket.io. It's essentially just a web-based editor.
Yeah.
But you can have a project set up with all the dependencies built in. So I've some kids doing some web programming, which is HTML, CSS, and then others doing Python. Mm-hmm. And they don't get bogged down in libraries or any of that kind of
stuff.
They open up the browser, they go to their project and they have a split screen, so they have kind of the results on one side and the code on the other. It's quite nice. Now, I mean, it wouldn't be scalable to a production system, but for learning Python, I mean, there's kids, who are, you know, pre-teenagers, and they're, I'm amazed at the stuff that they're doing in Python. You mm-hmm. know, it's
yeah,
great.
Those kind of newer, well, it's not new now, the Jupyter notebooks on Python.
What's that?
It's used a lot in people exploring data. Jupyter notebooks, just ordinary text, like your documentation, you write your paragraph text, and you can land into it a Python fragment, which is drawing a graph.
Oh, right, okay.
You can proceed with some more of your text. So it's like a live document with program execution in place on the page for different parts and, as you're explaining a concept or illustrating a mathematical technique of some kind. They use it a lot here. I think Kieran used it a lot with the second years or first years here.
Right, okay. That shows you how much we know about
each other. I didn't know that either.
I was like, a Jupyter notebook, is this some sort of NASA thing? right, I suppose to close up then, so here we are, we're recording this in 2022. What are the new ideas that we should look out for? You know, if there was any students who were listening, or even for ourselves, because we're always learning new things. What are the things that we should be looking out for? What should we, you know, if you're going to try something new, maybe try this. There might be something to this.
Okay, I'll say what you shouldn't do.
Okay, go for it.
Because it scares me. There's a new feature in GitHub called Copilot, and there's also a private company doing something similar. And they have basically harvested all the code in the world on your shoulder, and as you're typing, it's giving you hints as to what it thinks you're about to write. And right. It's generating a vast amount of code. And results are showing some pretty frightening types of productivity that are possible. You're not writing code, you're leaning on the code that is written, and you're doing things like writing a comment, and it's extrapolating from the comment what the function you're about to write would look like.
Okay.
So don't do that, okay. Because you have to learn that people who are productive with this new trend are expert programmers. So if you get to that level, this tool is like a turbocharger. It's quite extraordinary. Some of the results. Now, some people absolutely hate it, so it's quite controversial. But it's a big thing in the next few years.
Okay, but if you were trying to learn with that, it'd be like essentially having like the stabilizers on the bike.
To be like having stabilizers combined with a jetpack.
Okay. Yeah. And then you take them away and you're absolutely screwed.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Siobhan, and you think you should be looking out for? Well, jetpack and hose, you've
already mentioned
that.
Yeah, that's where, I suppose, like, it's where I'm going with the way that I'm learning at the moment, like, because we're constantly having to learn in the background. It's because we chose a field that has seismic kind of shifts every couple of years, you have to keep up with what's out there at the moment. And what's kind of grabbing my attention is that jetpack compose. Mm. Now, it mightn't go anywhere. You never know with new technologies whether it'll actually take off totally or not. But I do like the whole concept of write the logic once and deploy in loads of different places. And writing the logic once in a simple language like Kotlin, it's kind of like I started just kind of playing around with it and just producing different deployments to different types of platforms from a small piece of Kotlin code. And I was like, oh, yeah, I like that. Yeah, that's nice.
that concept is been transposed into Swift UI and Dart, which is more declarative programming as opposed to imperative. These are the two great divides from 50 years ago. We've been mostly working on the imperative side. Most of the languages we've discussed are imperative. These tools are bringing in a declarative element from the Lisp world and injecting it into the way we program, which is interesting.
Could you maybe explain what that is? What's the difference between the two?
It's a bit like you're describing in a program how to do something. It's imperative. You're giving it the instructions. And declarative means you're saying what you want done. And you're relying on the language mechanisms and tools to figure out how to do it.
Okay.
And that's a big productivity difference in terms of the amount of lines of code you might write. Because one of the strange features of programming is that most developers only write 5 lines a day. That's the average. No matter what language it is, whether it's a super modern language or a very old language, you still only do 5 lines a day in the industry. And the second feature, which is a bit alarming, is the number of bugs per line doesn't vary.
Okay.
So maybe declarative might be quite interesting to learn because it might make you very productive if you master some
and
of those
Flutter
tools.
And Dart use that, don't they? Isn't that declarative? Yeah. Yeah. And it kind of mixes together the UI and the kind of description of the UI and the piece of code associated with it, isn't it?
Yeah. That's great. Very interesting.
Yeah, it's a different way of learning coding. Yeah.
Okay, so is it a common thing? Actually, I think you taught it to me back in the 100 years ago, Eamon, was at the top of a function, just put a comment saying what you wanted this to do. Mm-hmm. Not how you're going to do it, just what you wanted it to do. And then you'd figure out the how as you went. And one of the common mistakes that I see with students is, I still do that today, is they just start hacking away, but they don't know what they want to do, but they're trying to do the how. So you're saying the what needs to come before the how, but this is in a more structural approach as opposed to shoehorning it in with the comment.
Yeah, it effectively slightly inverts the syntax you're doing. You're declaring the result and you're asking your tool, your language to make it happen rather than instructing it line by line, do this, do that, do the other.
Okay.
So the structure of your code starts to look quite different.
So to just summarize then, in order to get into this kind of more declarative structure, what would you recommend as the way to go?
I think it's two ways in. One is what Siobhan is talking about, which is mostly declarative structures around the UI. Mm-hmm. So, and then marrying your logic off that, which makes it which makes you more productive, I think, in that context. The ultimate destination of declarative programming is functional programming. Mm. And it's back to Lisp and it's back to the other side of the house, really. That is a minority interest, but has driven a lot of innovations in AI and knowledge-based systems over the years.
Mm. That's going to be, we'll put a pin in AI and knowledge-based systems because we definitely have to come back to that as a podcast in the not-too-distant future. Maybe in the next season, I think. That keeps coming up again and again as a request, so we'll definitely do that. Yeah. That's great. Siobhan and Eamon, that's been actually very an enlightening discussion. I've learned a lot, so thank you. If you want to learn more about us, we all have profiles up on the setu.ie website. You can check out the podcast at Machine Podcast on Twitter. There's a Facebook page as well, although I never update it. And this is the first of a series of episodes coming out weekly for the next few weeks. And then we'll have more episodes then in the new academic year. Eamon and Siobhan, thank you very, very much for your time.
Thanks.
Thank you.